Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't wanna die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't wanna die, but I'm on my own.
Morning, afternoon, evening, everybody.
Yes, good morning, afternoon, evening.
Welcome back to Mother Nature Will Kill You. It's been a while, actually, since we've recorded.
Yeah, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that.
Because you've been off on adventures and...
weddings.
Yeah.
What else did I do?
Went to the Outer Banks.
Was it just that? It was just that? It was just the wedding weekend? Yeah. Okay. It's like, good God, what have I been doing? I went home for my friend's wedding, and then we made a little vacation out of it. So,
yeah,
went to the Outer Banks, and
were the Outer Banks as lovely as ever?
Yeah, you know, you've been there. It's just a great spot. So
it's like a nostalgia thing, I think, for me now. You know, every time I go, it's like it makes me feel all warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, that's why I like it so much, because it's like the same for me too. It's like, this is where I went as a kid, and now my parents, like, they have a house there. So when I go back, it's like reliving all the good memories as a kid, you know? And so I took Alex to all these places that I've always enjoyed, and looked out a location, possible location for the wedding.
Yeah.
But the more that I think about it, the more that I don't think that we'll have it there, just because it's hard to get to. You know what I mean? Like, you would have to fly into the Norfolk airport or some other airport in North Carolina and then drive an hour or two still. You know, it's not like you're just landing at an airport and can drive like 30 minutes or 20 minutes. So I don't know. So we'll see. And then we were looking at some other venues in the Keys, just because that's where we live and it'd be easier to plan it logistically living down here.
Thankfully, I had most of our wedding planned before we left for Texas, but planning the rest of it from Texas was an interesting time.
Yeah, so I don't know. I was looking at the Hemingway House and Fort Zach. So the thing with, I've always wanted the Hemingway House. I think it's really pretty, and I've been following them on Instagram for their events page for like a couple of years now. So I see how pretty weddings can be there. But the problem is that they have a max capacity of 100 people. And like, if we just invited our friends and family with no significant other, like not significant other, but like no plus one.
Yeah.
And like no kids, that would be like, I don't know, 100 so people. Yeah. So in like factoring in like 30% are going to say no. So that'd be like 94 people, but like give or take a few. So it's like we'd be pushing it with just like the friends and families with no other additions. And then Fort Zach has like places there where you could do like 100 people max, 200 people max, or like 300 people max. So there's variety there. So I don't know. Still haven't made a decision on that. But
take, when we were you in know, take your time, because, but it is a pretty good day. And like, you want it to be a good time for everyone. Like, that's how I saw it. Like, it wasn't like the ceremony was for me and Corey. The reception also, I guess, was for me and Corey, but it was more like for everybody to be there and celebrate. And so that's what I cared about the most. But, you know, so just take your time and make sure it's right, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. But when we were in the Outer Banks, we were looking at the historic Corolla Park as a venue reception.
Oh, yeah.
Ceremony. because there's a little chapel that's there, and we go to that chapel for holidays whenever we do holidays in the Outer Banks. So, like, I've been to that chapel before, and come to find out, my mom donates to that chapel too. So she, like, we were like in with the chapel, yeah, you know. Yeah. And then the historic Corolla Park is like really nice because it's like, you know, that historic waterfowl hunting property that's right there. And then there's like the conservation environmental center that's right there, and then like the maritime museum and the lighthouse. So it's like,
so there's all these tie-ins. Yeah,
it's all these tie-ins and like of all these things that Alex and I both enjoy, and it's like a special place to me. And I mean, what we want to do for the wedding is just to have it be like a, you know, the reception, at least to have like a big family party. Like, we want yard games. We want like, you know, card games. Like, we want just like games around.
Yeah.
And so that property would allow us to do that. But again, it's just going to be hard for everybody to get there. And I don't want to make it hard on people because I know how hard weddings already are on people. So I don't want to make it harder on people. And like, if we did it in Key West, you know, it would be like, all the bars are there. There's plenty of hotels that are there. The airport's right there. There's Ubers around. Like, it would just be so easy to do that.
Plus, people love the Keys. Like, everybody wants to go to the Keys. Not that they wouldn't want to go to the Outer Banks, but
Yeah. No, I agree. And that was another thing that we talked about too, was like the Keys, like, it would still be a destination wedding, even though it's like where we live. But like, it, it's like a spot that's like a bucket list travel place for people, you know, and they're like, oh, I've always wanted to go to the Keys or Key West or yada, yada, yada. And it's like, well, now you can come for our wedding.
Exactly.
So we'll see what happens.
That's good. And just, take it easy. It's, you know, it's stressful, but it shouldn't be as stressful as a lot of people make it out to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know, like, I was talking to him about Fort Zach the other day, and he was like, well, are you sure you want to do it there? I was like, well, now you're making me double guess myself. Like, I don't know. It seems like logical, and it seems nice, and it seems super easy to do because they have like an event coordinator that like helps you through all of it. And I was like, I don't know. I've always thought Fort Zach was pretty. And actually, one of his coworkers got married at Fort Zach. So I was like, ask him what it was like.
Yeah, it's a pretty property for sure. Yeah,
and then another one got married at the Hemingway House. And he was like, you know, they do weddings there. And it's still like a really like awesome location. And the thing about the Hemingway House, too, is that it is right in front of the lighthouse where we got engaged. So like, our photos would have like our engagement like background scene there, and then like it'd be like our wedding scene. So I don't know, we'll figure it out.
Exactly.
So we'll see. And Alex was like, can I just text everybody and ask them if they'd come just to get like a soft RSVP, or is that not allowed? And I was like, it's not really the best look, but I agree with you. I feel like we should do that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So but anyway, that was a long tangent to say that the vacation was good and the Outer Banks was nice, and we did a lot in 2.5 days that we were down there. So it was good. However,
we're known for our long tangents. So, but today we got to jump into it because when I was writing this, it's longer than my usual. But I was like, I do not want to cut this into 3 episodes.
Oh God. Yeah. You're like, I just want to get it over with.
I just want to do it. So that being said, we're jumping back into the race for the South Pole, and this shit is gonna get intense. We're definitely gonna talk or do a trigger warning for suicide, and also for just talk of death, I guess. So trigger warnings for that, but this is a really interesting story, and it is very pivotal story to the history of the Antarctic continent as far as like human beings and scientific exploration is concerned, and it is the namesake of the South Pole base. So
McMurdo Station,
not McMurdo. But funny enough, McMurdo is on the same island where Scott had his hut point and the Terra Nova hut. So it's, they took, you know, that area that Scott was using and turn it into a McMurdo, basically.
Gotcha.
And the huts are still there, and you can go see them.
Okay.
It's like a day's trek out from McMurdo. So,
yeah.
But the huts are all still historically intact and all that stuff, which is pretty cool. So it's both the Discovery Hut and the Terra Nova Expedition Hut. So, fun fact.
That is a fun fact.
That's where McMurdo is. Okay. So, when we last left Robert Falcon Scott and Roald Amundsen, they were overwintering at their respective bases. So, the Terra Nova Hut and Framheim, waiting for the spring thaw to begin their race to the South Pole. Amundsen was anxious to get going. And when the sun finally appeared on the horizon for the first time since April, on August 24th. So that's how many months of darkness? Like 6 months of darkness.
Yeah, so it's been dark this whole time. Like literally they've had to have lamps this whole time.
Yeah.
Like not even like that Alaskan winter time where it's like, what is it, like twilight out all the time or whatever?
Yeah, well, I think towards the end, like the beginning and the end of it, they get twilight. So it's not 100% dark. But I mean, that's like at least 3 months of complete darkness.
Doesn't that make them go insane?
That's the thing. There's a lot of stories of explorers in the Antarctic and the Arctic that have a lot of trouble with that.
Okay. That makes, I mean, I would believe that. That makes a lot of sense.
Like overwintering in Antarctica is like notoriously difficult even now. Like modern day scientists do it from time to time.
Yeah.
And even with all of our modern amenities, just not having light, like sunlight, like really fucks with people.
Yeah.
More so than like the 24 hours of daylight.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. So.
Because I feel like your brain just goes to dark places when it's in darkness.
Like there's a reason why we're not nocturnal, you know?
Yeah.
We weren't built for that environment, and all of our big scary prehistoric predators in our minds are still out there waiting for us, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So on August 24th, Amundsen wanted to get going. However, temperatures suddenly plummeted to -72°F.
Oof.
And Amundsen was forced to wait, or the dogs would have a difficult time in those conditions, which, like, no shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he could risk losing men, which wouldn't be good either.
Mm-mm.
One of his crewmen said, "The thought of the English gave him no peace, for if we were not the first to the pole, we might as well just stay home." So this was their mindset about the pole.
Yeah.
It's very much to both
all or
parties.
Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, you don't want to, like, kill people unnecessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I agree. Yeah. Did you get my text about the Lost City of Z?
I did.
Have you seen that?
I haven't.
Oh my God, you should watch it. It's on Amazon Prime. Sorry. Okay. That sentence you just said about, like, not wanting to kill people reminded me of that I watched last night. So sorry.
Maybe I'll watch it today because I'm just going to be laying around after this.
Yeah. It's based on a true story. I was like Googling while I was watching it to see like how much of it was aligned with the true story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like if you want to do that story, I'm down. Like, just make it happen.
Yeah. Sorry. First tangent of the pod.
No, it's fine. So Amundsen attempted to make a start again on September 8th with a caravan of 90 dogs and their teams that set forward, but temperatures dropped overnight again on September 11th, so 3 days out, to -70°F. So
golly.
They're still having these extreme cold because it's spring in Antarctica. And when it's spring in other places, you get like a cold front and a warm front and a cold front and a warm front. But it's like 20 times worse in Antarctica because it's Antarctica. Right?
Yeah.
So unfortunately, the dogs' feet were getting frostbitten. The fluid in their compasses was frozen, which meant they really couldn't get an accurate location. Admundson stated of the incident to risk men and animals out of sheer obstinacy and continue, just because we have started our way, that would never occur to me. If we are to win this game, the pieces must be moved carefully. One false move and everything can be lost. They returned to Framheim on September 12th. The decision to head back to camp started a conflict between some of the crewmen and Admundson, as he had uncharacteristically sped off, leaving some of the men to make it back on their own. Some had frostbite, and there was limited supplies, but ultimately everyone returned. However, a handful of the dogs perished in the conditions.
No.
The conflict between Admundson and one of the men was so great that Admundson took the man off the polar party for insubordination.
What's that mean again?
Yeah, it was an uncharacteristic moment of disorganization for an otherwise organized and level-headed leader.
What does insubordination mean again?
I guess it's like...
like they weren't doing things properly?
Yeah.
Like they were going
against
the rules?
It's like a lot of... it's a military kind of term, typically.
Yeah, and I'm really bad with military terms.
And I'm tired, so... defiance of authority and refusal to obey orders.
Gotcha, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, wasn't really doing things properly.
Yeah. So, but at the same time, it's like he kind of sped off and left a bunch of people in the dust. So, I personally, when I found that out, I was like, well, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
You know, you want these men to be very, like, you know, that you want them to be good leaders. And then you have to remember that they're also just human.
Yeah.
And sometimes shit like this happens, and bad decisions are made. Ultimately, though, nobody died other than the dogs, which isn't great. But
well, I mean, obviously, I have a soft spot for dogs, so
I do,
I'm gonna
I
think
do
that's
too.
Sad. But at least it's not humans.
It is interesting how we uphold, especially in places like this, human life above animal life, like with. You know, it's hard, I think, in a lot of circumstances, but it's just something we accept that has to be done. But I'm like looking at my dog and I was like, I could never do that. I would just starve.
Yeah.
I would just
I agree.
starve.
Like so, that's what, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't. I could never. I can't even watch a movie where, like, there's some sort of, like, heartstring being pulled about the relationship between a human and a dog without, like, tears coming to my eyes.
Yeah.
And then I look at my dog and I'm like, oh, come here.
So it's so true, though. Finally, they were able to depart from Framheim with 52 dogs on October 19th after conditions improved consistently. Amundsen's party consisted of 5 men, 4 sledges, and 52 dogs. The 4 men with him included an expert dog driver, sailor, and navigator Helmer Hansen, an Arctic veteran with expert dog handling experience, Svara Passel. I even wrote the pronunciation. Naval gunner and jack of all trades, Oscar Wisting, who had also become skilled with dogs and was an amateur vet at this point. Champion skier and skilled carpenter Olav Bjaaland. And that was his team. So he's really like picking like the peak people, the people you're going to want to take with you on something like this. By October 24th, Admundson, his men, and the dog teams had made 150 miles, giving them a major head start over Scott, who was still a week away from leaving the pole. They drove their dogs for just 5 or 6 hours a day, saving their strength for later and resting them at hourly intervals. Admundson stated of his happiness with the dogs, "Thus far, the trip has been a good one for the animals. We never had to move a foot. All we had to do was let ourselves be towed." And they were traveling twice as fast as Scott could. They also, thanks to their depot laying, stocked 10 times the amount of food and fuel per man than the British did, which built them a safety net if they ran into bad weather and had to, like, shelter in place.
That's good thinking.
Yeah. So it's because of these things, though, that they faced criticism later on, especially with the dogs, because it's like they didn't do any of the hauling themselves. They didn't do any walking yeah. themselves. But it's like they're just, to me, it's like they're just using the best mode of transport.
As working smarter, not harder.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Meanwhile, Scott had to wait for the weather to warm up before he could use the ponies and the motor sledges on the barrier stage of the South Pole trip, because both needed warmer weather to really function. From Hut Point to the South Pole and back was 1,532 nautical miles, or 1,766 standard miles. And the difference between a nautical miles and standard miles are just like the miles we use on land, basically. Mm-hmm.
And isn't it like nautical miles are like 1.5 miles longer than a land mile?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes, because it's based on like the curvature of the earth and degrees of latitude and shit like that. Mm-hmm. And it's how you navigate on like big spaces of the globe, which you would use yeah. in the ocean. But I'm not 100% still on what the difference is, other than one's longer. But,
yeah,
you know,
well, it's like measuring wind and knots versus miles per hour, because right. like miles per hour and knots, like at low speeds, it's like it's one knot more than like what the mile per hour would be. But then as you get into the higher knots, it starts getting like a little bit more than 1 mile per yeah. hour difference. Yeah. So yeah,
it's like math and stuff that I,
which I'm not great at. We all know yeah. that. Yeah. So
climbing the Beardmore Glacier, which is what they would do to get up onto like the south, or the polar plateau where the South Pole was,
mm-hmm.
climbing the glacier alone was 100 miles longer than the explorer Robert Perry had to cover to get to the North Pole just a few oh, wow. years earlier. So we're the South Pole, the distances here that they have to cover are so much bigger than anything anyone for like the North Pole, which I didn't realize. That's like crazy. The English team scheme was to average about 10 to 13 miles a day via pony, dog, or man hauling, depending on like what stage they were at. They mm-hmm. departed from Cape Evans on the 1st of November, at least 2 to 3 weeks after Amundsen. On the barrier, which was the Ross Ice Shelf, the men dealt with conditions that ranged from sweltering days, the air breathless, the glare intense. One loses the sight of the fact that the temperature is low, i.e. negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit, to windy and almost blizzard conditions. So,
oh my goodness.
They're dealing with a lot. They reached the one-ton depot on the 15th of November and were only a little over a third of the distance to the Beardmore Glacier and only 130 miles from Hut Point, where they started out. The plan was that the ponies would be taken to the base of the glacier and then killed in order to feed the dogs. And because this decision was made, 100 pounds of pony food had been left at One Ton Depot to save on weight, because they didn't need it. They'd be killing them, right?
Yeah.
The ponies also had already been developing strange behavior anyway and were no longer eating.
Oh, what? But
yeah. Yeah.
Because what kind of strange behavior? Is that a question?
They would chew like on all kinds of like leather objects.
Oh, and because like, they're like nutrient deficient. They're like trying to
yeah.
get more nutrients. What is that, like pika? Is that called pika? Well, that's in dogs when they like lick tiles and stuff. Is that yeah. a thing?
I don't know, because it could also just be that they're in a place that's so like different from anything that they're
like
were
stressed.
Yes. So I almost wonder if it was like a stress condition.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, like, they would chew up all these leather objects and gear that the men needed to get to the South Pole So they had to like hide their gear as much as they could and like tie the ponies up so that they couldn't get to them because they weren't eating their food and instead were chewing up all of their leather.
Oh my God.
So ponies should not be in this environment.
No,
And it's
clearly
crazy.
not.
It's crazy that they tried to do this, in my personal opinion, because, yeah, I don't
Yeah.
know. I know horses. I used to ride them all the time, and I didn't ride this particular breed of horse, but they can be extremely hardy, but like barely anything can live out in this.
Oh,
And
yeah. It's so
it's,
cold.
yeah. And you look at a horse wrong and they'll fucking fall over. So, you know, they're like, they're great until they get hurt and then they're done. You know
Nothing.
what I mean?
Yeah. That's why they have to get euthanized all the time, because it's like, yeah.
It's because
Sad.
they're putting all of their weight, partially this is it's because they're putting all of their weight basically on one toe.
Oh.
So their legs are very delicate.
That makes sense. I never thought of it that way, but that does make sense.
So anyway, the ponies were experiencing a pony mental breakdown. I do feel bad for them, but like, so each pony, once killed, would provide 4 days of food for the dog teams. So they're a substantial addition, I guess, to the dogs. So it's
Yeah.
like they're killing one animal to prolong the lives of others. I don't know. As they moved past One Ton Depot, they began setting up additional depots that would be instrumental to the Polar Party upon their return back, including the Upper Barrier Depot on November 21st. They had now traveled 192 miles. I have this neat little infographic that kind of explains what we're looking at as far as like supplies and men and dogs taken to the pole. Because after this barrier stage, where Scott's using the ponies and the dogs and the motor sledges, they're going to be exclusively man hauling after this point. So they're only going to be using men pulling sledges to get there.
And how much longer of the journey is it once they start using men, did you say?
Oh, I don't know. I
Is it
know
like
their total journey is 60 miles longer than Admundson's,
okay.
but it's going to be like several hundred miles from Beardmore to the Polar Plateau to the South Pole.
Gotcha.
So they're literally just going to be hauling for months.
Yeah, because you said they were going to do like what, 10 to 13 miles a day. So, yeah, that's a lot of math.
Yeah, heavy pulling, heavily laden sledges.
Is it like, I don't know, I would say after a week, the crew would start breaking down. That's just me. I think if I was in that position, I'd give myself a week before I start like having a mental breakdown.
It took him a long time. It took
Yeah.
a very long time for a breakdown to happen. And I
Well,
think
that's
it's
good for them.
because a lot of these guys are military men.
Oh, true.
A lot of them have prior polar experience. And this is the way the English tended to get around in the poles.
Yeah.
Like Shackleton was planning on doing the same thing before their expedition was cut short. And I don't know if it's like English stubbornness. I know Scott and Shackleton both felt that you couldn't use dogs on the glacier because it was so dangerous
Yeah.
because of all of like the crevasses and stuff. But Admundson didn't feel that way. So he was going to take the dogs all the way to the pole.
Interesting.
But he also has three times the supplies that Scott does, and he has like three times less men
Yeah, I'm looking
than
at your
Scott does.
comparison and Ardmanson or Admins, how do you pronounce your name?
Amundsen?
Admanson.
Yeah.
Because it's too small for me. I need to zoom in. Yeah, but Admundson, it says like the expedition took 52 huskies, 5 men, and 3 tons of supplies.
Yeah.
Where Scott, it says his expedition took 17 men and 1 ton of supplies. Yeah,
Like,
very
consider the
different.
math on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about. Amundsen had like a fallback as far as like their food and stuff was concerned. Like if they had to get like camp out for days because of like a blizzard, they wouldn't starve.
Mm-hmm.
So, which will become a problem later for the English team.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's that. I love that infographic. I'll put it on Instagram because I think it's a good one.
That is, yeah, it is a good one. I agree.
Because I talk a lot about they had this many dogs and this many supplies and they did this and this and this, but this kind of like streamlines it for you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So a few days earlier on November 17th, the Norwegian teams had reached the Transantarctic Mountains, which line the eastern continental edge of Antarctica. So this is the major barrier that both Scott and Amundsen have to cross. And they're going to do so by using glaciers and using the glaciers to travel up the mountains instead of like going mountain climbing, basically.
Okay. Interesting.
They left more supplies here and carried enough food with them for 60 days on their dog sledges. They began looking for a route they could take from the bottom of the Transantarctic Mountains up onto the plateau, similar how Scott was planning on using the Beardmore Glacier. Amundsen, however, had no set route. So remember, he's doing this all from scratch. So it's kind of guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
And he was traveling through uncharted territory. Like, nobody really knew what was here. But eventually, on November 19th or 20th, they found a glacier that was 30 miles long that led up to the polar plateau. Amundsen named the glacier after Axel Heiberg, who was one of the expedition's major financial backers. And honestly, that's how most stuff in Antarctica got its name.
Yeah, just from naming after people that financed the expedition or something.
Yeah, but it's just kind of depressing to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's by these, like, it's named after these rich people who've, like, never been to Antarctica and aren't doing, like, the backbreaking work, you know?
Yeah, it's a bummer.
It is a bummer. Bad weather prevented them from leaving the barrier until the 25th. They began traveling into the unknown with poor visibility from fog and dangerous crevasses hidden from them underneath the snow. After managing to bring his men and 42 dogs up the glacier in a few days, they reached an altitude of 10,000 feet above sea level. So these are big mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Amundsen said of the dogs, "Come and say dogs cannot be used here," in response to Shackleton and Scott's reluctance to use dog teams on the glaciers.
Hmm.
So you could.
He was like, "I'll show them." And they're like, "See, it's fine." Yeah.
Right. And now they have dogs to pull them all the way to the pole. They're not, you know. And that's the other thing is like, you use so much more energy pulling these supplies than you would if you were just skiing alongside or riding on the back of a sledge. Like,
mm-hmm.
And then when you consider like the supply difference too, it's crazy to me.
You crazy girl.
So unfortunately, however, the plan was to kill a portion of the dogs to feed to the dogs that would continue on, which I think in modern day, like even doing this kind of exploration in Antarctica, this would be unthinkable, right? But in this case, there's literally nothing out there for them to use. And so they are just trying to maximize calories. And unfortunately, that involves considering the animals that are pulling them there as like those calories, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, but at the same time, it's common during this time period. It's very common. But it's not like they were just like, okay, we'll just go kill some dogs and, you know, whatever. It was a difficult task for the Norwegians because they loved their animals. And so this camp was called Slakteri, or the butchery. And many of them considered this spot haunted because of what they had to do and like the lives that were ultimately lost here. And at this point, they were still 300 miles away from the South Pole. So I have a picture of the glacier. It's pretty substantial. So this is what they were climbing up with the dogs.
Let me get to it. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is really substantial.
Yeah. Scott and the English also had begun slaughtering their animals, as the first pony was killed when they were still 90 miles away from the glacier on the 29th of November. They had to kill it because it was starting to just get too weak to carry on. So, yeah. After 300 miles, they reached and surpassed Scott's prior for the south location from the 1902 Discovery Expedition. At latitude 82 degrees 21 minutes. That's right, south, right? Decimal minutes, decimal degrees minutes. What is it? No, it's degrees, minutes, seconds. That's what it is. Sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I know that seconds are definitely in there somewhere, but you're asking the wrong person for that.
I should know because I use this all the time.
Yeah.
On the 5th of December, 12 miles from the base of the glacier, they were struck by a strange blizzard that had high snowfall, but also high temperatures.
Why is it considered strange, though?
I know. And it's 27 to 33 degrees Fahrenheit, which are all temperatures that we know and have experienced. So it's not, like, crazy cold.
But, like, why would it be considered a strange blizzard? Because it popped out of nowhere?
Because it had such high temperatures.
Oh, high temperatures. Yeah. I see. I see what you're saying. Okay. That's
usually temperatures will plummet into the negatives.
Yeah. Okay.
Blizzard, but it was above freezing.
Technically. Yeah. And they're like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. I see.
So because it was above freezing, things started melting and like they're laying on the snow with their body heat. So it made everyone in the tent wet and miserable as they were forced to wait out the storm.
Fair.
Which fucking sucks.
Yeah.
They were forced, unfortunately, to begin eating some of the glacier rations during the wait. So they had, like, set aside certain rations for certain legs of the journey. And they already had to break into their glacier rations. By the 8th of December, the storm has subsided, and they continued on the following day to the base of the glacier. For an idea, because I think this is fun, of what their rations were like, here's a list of one day's rations per man. So we have 16 ounces of biscuit, which I believe are cookies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would make sense if they're English, right?
Yeah. 12 ounces of pemmican, which is a mixture of dried meat tallow and sometimes dried berries. And it's like this very like a nutrient dense food that is often used in like the Arctic. Like Inuits also eat it. And it's like, it's basically like better jerky, like more nutrient rich jerky.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. They also had 2 ounces of butter, 2 ounces of cocoa, which they often had like chocolate and cocoa on these trips because it's another easily storable nutrient dense kind of food, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
They had 3 ounces of sugar and 0.86 ounces of tea because they are British after all.
Yes.
With a little onion powder and salt. And that is the day's ration, basically.
Wow.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Interesting.
So really, really high cuisine.
Yeah, seriously. Some hot cocoa and some beef jerky and cookies.
Yep. That's it. So on December 8th, after summiting the Hyberg Glacier, Admundson and his men passed Shackleton's furthest south record of 88 degrees 23 minutes south and entered the white flat mirage filled landscape of the polar plateau. So there's literally nothing but white stretching out as far as the eye can see on this plateau.
Oh, wow. It's
And
like a
I have a
desert.
picture of it a little further down. We'll get to it, but
Okay.
it's like mind-numbingly dull, like to look at.
Oh,
Like it's
yeah.
just a big white expanse, basically.
It like a desert for sure.
Yeah. So now that 88 degrees was passed, we were further south than any human being had ever been. No other moment of the whole trip affected me like this, Edmondson said of the moment. They had began looking anxiously for any sign that the English had beat them to the pole. So things like flags or sledge markings, discarded gear, as they began making their way into the strange white landscape. They even momentarily thought that their dog's own feces were the flags that the English had put up in the distance on December 12th, but it was just a mirage, similar to
God.
those encountered on the barrier, basically fooling their sight into thinking that close objects were actually much further away.
Yeah, wow.
So it's a
That's
very
crazy.
trippy
Yeah.
environment.
Wow, weird.
Yeah.
Did you say that in the last episode?
I did.
Okay. I was gonna say either I'm having deja vu or you actually did say that in the last episode. I don't know. It's, I am tired to the point where I would have believed the deja vu thing. So I was like, that sounds really familiar.
Yeah, I did say that in the last episode. So on December 14th, 19 or sorry, that's nope, that's 1911. That's correct. Sorry. Amundsen and his party reached the South Pole. They planted a Norwegian flag on the spot, naming the plateau King Haakon the Seventh. That's seven plateau after the Norwegian king. I don't read Roman
Roman
numerals
numeral,
very
yeah.
after six, I'm like, I don't
I was thinking about Roman numerals the other day because I saw it listed somewhere and I was like, I remember learning about this in like middle school,
Yeah.
but I don't even know. I
Nope.
don't use it.
Mm-mm.
I didn't use it, so I lost it.
Yep. Amundsen mused on the experience. Never has a man achieved a goal so diametrically opposed to his wishes. The area around the North Pole, devil take it, had fascinated me since childhood, and now here I was at the South Pole. Could anything be more crazy? Because originally he wanted to try to go for the North Pole, right?
Yeah, he
And then
did.
somebody else beat him to it. So he was like, well, let's just see how this goes.
Yeah.
So he, Hansen, Hassel, Wisting, and Bjaaland became the first humans to ever reach the South Pole, and they did beat the English. Following this achievement, the men spent the next 3 days fixing the exact position on the pole so that there would be no contest or criticism. Since the sun doesn't change position much at the pole during this time of year, because it's daylight for 24 hours, it was really difficult to get the calculations right because the sun isn't moving, and that's what you need to be able to get those
Yeah.
calculations. So it took several days of recalculating, retaking measurements, triangulating, doing all that. I have done it, and I have lost the information or like the knowledge of like how to do like celestial sighting, but I did
Yeah.
do it at one point. I didn't know how to do it. It's a lot of math. It's a lot of math. Once the calculations were correct, they pitched a tent and dubbed it Polheim. And they pitched it as near to the pole as possible and placed letters for Scott to find. And then they returned there, or they went on their way to return back to Framheim. So, pole has been reached, race has been won, right? Story
Yeah.
must be over, right?
You would think, but I'm assuming it's not.
Right. So we do have pictures of them at the South Pole. It's really, really stark, very cold looking place. And there's no like barber pole like we imagine at the South Pole. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like the Santa
Stand a
Claus kind of
pole with the
pole.
white and red spiral. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no like wooden sign that's carved in with like a knife that says North Pole.
Yeah, not at this time anyway.
Yeah.
So they had to figure out where it was. Meanwhile, Scott had no idea that he had already lost the race.
Oh my goodness.
So they're still going. So the ponies were killed for dog rations on December 10th, and the teams began climbing the Beardmore Glacier with three four-man pulling teams pulling 500 pounds each on December 11th up a fucking glacier.
Yeah, that's insane.
Many of the men got snow blindness as they were now day marching to ensure that they wouldn't miss any of the dangers on the glacier. So they're marching in like peak sun, pretty much. So they used their tea leaves, zinc powder, and even cocaine to calm the pain and burning.
They brought cocaine with them. Do you think they were snorting cocaine on this trip, like for recreational purposes?
I don't really think, like, back then, I feel like it was seen as medical.
Medicine, yeah.
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 So maybe, but maybe it was, like, for medicine purposes. Yeah. Like, not like, well, I'm going to do some drugs and, like, get to the South Pole, man.
Wild.
It's a different time.
Yeah. So wild, though.
There's a quote. I can't remember what podcast it's from, but talking about, like, I think it might be morbid, but talking about, like, how back in the 1900s, you know, and to solve any of your medical issues, you just, like, did some cocaine about it.
Yeah. Just a bump here and there.
So, yeah. So they did have cocaine.
Wild. That is so wild.
Yeah.
That's a drug that I've never been interested in trying. Never.
Yeah.
Like, I know people that have done it. I know people who have tried it once. Like, I just, to me, it's one of those things where I feel like it's easy to overdose on it. So I'm just like, no, that's not for me. Don't feel like doing it. Never gonna do it.
I also feel like once you start doing cocaine, you don't stop doing cocaine.
Yeah.
Like, it's really addictive, really, addictive, yeah. Really quickly. Yeah. But, you know, if you're going to Antarctica, just do some cocaine and you'll get there. You'll get to South Pole.
Yeah. When they were talking about, like, the speed, is that, like, you know, are they, like, speed as in, like, fast or, like, speed as in drugs?
Just took a little speed. That's how they were man-hauling so well. That's why nobody, like, because they were all on cocaine. They were all...
Oh my god.
We gotta get there, guys. We gotta get there.
Yeah, they're just cracked out. Oh my god. Wild.
Okay, so. So they dealt with crossing mazes of crevasses that often would just be covered by snow bridges, which often were strong enough to keep the men from falling through, but that was not always the case. So the going was slow and careful. In describing falling through one of these snow bridges, Cherry Garrard, who is the writer of the book The Worst Journey in the World, which is where I got most of this from.
Yeah.
He wrote, "It's a bit of a jar when it gives way underneath you, but the friendly harness is made to trust one's life to. The Lord only knows how deep these vast chasms go. They seem to extend into blue-black nothingness for thousands of feet." So that was what it was like. They're just nonchalantly, like, hanging there, like, interesting.
Cool. Yeah.
Just waiting to get rescued. Yeah.
Like, all right, when's our ship coming in?
Yep. So at the time, the Beardmore Glacier was thought to be the largest glacier in the world at approximately 125 miles long. So just as a reminder, the Axel Heiberg Glacier was only 30 miles long.
Oh, my God.
So no wonder they're so fucking far behind.
Yeah.
They're like, that big glacier, the biggest one in the world, that's our ticket. That's the ticket. Its summit was 7,000 feet above the barrier. The trek up the glacier went surprisingly well, though, and four men, including Cherry Garrard, were sent back to Cape Evans once they reached the top, and then eight men would carry on to the polar plateau, continuing to drop supply depots. So the reason why they brought so many men is because they had to keep dropping supply depots along the way.
Okay. But
Scott was only planning on taking four of them with him to the pole because that's just the way the supplies were working out. So they spent Christmas on the plateau, with I know. The small feast consisting of pemmican, biscuits, chocolate eclairs, which interesting.
Fancy. Yeah.
Pony meat, plum pudding with crystallized ginger, and 4 caramels each. So very interesting.
It's like a lot of sweets.
Yeah. Which I guess, like, if you're like pulling for miles, like 500 pounds a day, like, fuck it.
You need
eat
the sugar?
A bunch. Yeah. Eat some eclairs. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's when
sugary
you get
bread.
To. Yeah. Conditions on the polar plateau proved to be challenging as the constant pitiless wind combined with the altitude and low temperatures, which has made traveling on the Antarctic plateau so difficult. And that's from Scott's diary. On New Year's Day, they surpassed Shackleton's furthest south point at the 88th parallel with only 180 miles until they reached the South Pole. So they're almost there. Scott Good. Would soon have to decide who he was going to take with him to the pole. As, like I said, there was only rations planned out for 4 men.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, however, he ended up choosing 5 men. Cherry Garrard assumed this was because Scott had wanted to take as many men to the pole as possible. Because it is a big achievement. He wanted to share that with as many people as he could.
Yeah.
The party of 5 included himself, Henry Bowers, who was 28, Lawrence Titus Oates, who was 32, Edward Wilson, who was 39, and Seaman Edgar Evans, who was 37. So they're all kind of around our age.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That is really interesting.
Wilson was a naturalist and a physician and served as their doctor. Oates was a British Army captain. Bowers was a sailor and skilled navigator, and Evans was a British Navy petty officer and one of the strongest members on the team. So they do have some things that they need. Like, obviously, you'd want a doctor. Navigators are good. But when you compare it to Admonson's group, like, the specialties of these guys don't really match up. Because, like, Admonson had, like, dog handlers, skiers, like, these experts with polar exploration, and a lot of these guys are military men.
Yeah. You
know? So it's interesting to compare.
It is.
The choices that were made.
Yeah, I agree.
So stores were quickly rearranged to make rations available for 5 men instead of 4. Cherry Garrard described the situation in that he decided to take the extra man at the last moment, and in doing so, he added one more link in the chain. And we will get to what that chain is.
Yeah, soon. I'm interested.
The men were considered strong men with sledging experience, accustomed to cold temperatures, none likely to panic under any circumstances. So these were, at this point, experienced men.
Okay.
They were also given pairs of skis the first time they would use skis during the whole trip, but they only had 4, as originally only 4 men were going forward. So the 5th man would have to walk alongside the sledge. And then they would trade off. You know,
yeah,
who's
it's
walking.
Like, you walk a little bit, I'll walk a little bit.
Yeah. This was the last any of the return parties would see of these 5 men for a long time.
That does not sound good.
I have a picture below of the Beardmore Glacier. Remember you saw the picture of the Axel Heiberg Glacier? And it was a picture. Mm-hmm. It was all contained within one photograph. I couldn't find one of the Beardmore Glacier, so I had to get a satellite to contain the whole
thing. Oh, wow.
That's how fucking big it is.
That's insane.
So that's what that is. It's huge compared to the Heiberg Glacier.
Oh my God.
And then below that is a picture of the polar plateau.
Yeah, it looks like an ice desert.
And that's just what it looks like for hundreds of miles.
Yeah.
Which, navigating in that, are you kidding me? That'd be insane.
Yeah.
There's no landmarks.
Yeah, I would not be able to do that. I would go insane. You know what that kind of reminds me of, though? This is going to sound so dumb. You remember that episode of SpongeBob where they're like, oh, the pioneers used to ride these babies for miles. And then, like...
Where they're delivering the pizza and then they get
Yeah.
lost.
Yeah. Like that scene where they're like walking through a blizzard with the pizza, just trying to keep the lid down. And then like they come across like the boulder and like, oh, it's a boulder. Yeah. It's like, oh, the pioneers used to ride these babies for miles. Like this, the polar plateau reminds me of like what that cartoon drawing was when they like took off on the boulder or the rock, whatever words they used for
We always
that.
bring it back to SpongeBob.
Yeah,
It's
dude,
always
it's always a SpongeBob reference.
Admundsen and the Polar Party returned to Framheim in a little over a month, leaving the pole on December 18th and returning on January 25th. While Amundsen was determined to return to civilization with his muse, he limited the distances traveled to 15 miles to preserve the dogs and men. So he's still taking that into consideration, trying to get as many animals and people alive as possible back. When they reached the glacier, their pace slowed due to the dangers of the glacier, but then their pace picked up to 30 miles a day when they
Oh,
reached the
wow.
barrier.
Wow, 30 miles a day.
So,
That's a lot. Like people that walk the Appalachian Trail don't even walk that much in a day.
But and it's like triple what Scott can do,
Yeah.
you know?
That's insane.
So, of the 52 dogs that had started out, only 11 survived.
Oh
So
gosh.
that was the great sacrifice that was made
Yeah.
in order for this to happen.
Oh, that stinks.
So they only 11 survived pulling two sledges. Because most of the sledges were carrying food, they were able to return much lighter than they had left. So that's why they were able to only get away with like two sledges. The entire trip had taken 99 days, and the Norwegian covered 1,860 miles in total.
Oh, wow.
Upon return to Cape Evans and Hut Point, however, all of the men from Scott's returning parties, all they could do was wait for the polar party to arrive. Months went by, and there was no word from Scott and the four that went with him. By March 25th, the last date the polar party was expected to be back in, there was still no sign of them.
Oh, gosh, not good.
No. Cherry Garrard wrote in his diary, "We are now on the days when I expect the polar party in. I pray to God I may be right." When the polar party failed to show up in the next couple of days, the barrier was searched for the missing men, but soon the weather descended into deep winter, and soon searching was impossible due to the extreme cold. So again, they had to wait over the winter before they could figure out what happened to them.
And like it's probably safely assumed that they are dead, right?
At this
Gotcha.
point,
That
which we've
stinks.
kind of been leading up to that, but
Yeah.
they're gonna uncover exactly what happened to these guys, which
Oh,
makes
goodness.
this like so much more heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Amundsen departed. Oh, and at this point, they don't really know if they've even reached the pole.
That's true because their like navigational things are all frozen, right? So they can't even really tell.
Well, it's because the parties that returned didn't go all the way to the pole with Scott.
Oh, right.
So they don't even know if he made it or not.
Yeah.
Amundsen
Wow.
departed. And then you have to wait a winter to even
Yeah.
go look for them
Oh my goodness,
on
not
this
good.
giant continent.
Yeah.
Amundsen departed from the Bay of Whales on the Fram on January 30th, 1912, arriving in Hobart, Australia on March 7th. He sent telegrams first to his brother, then to famous Norwegian polar explorer Fridtjof Nansen and
Redraw.
King Haakon. From here, the news spread to the entire world. There was still no news of Scott, and while Amundsen's claim was accepted, the world waited with bated anticipation for the English expedition to come back, giving the world the full story. In the meantime, Amundsen went on a whirlwind tour of interviews, lectures, and wrote the book The South Pole. His world tour took him all over Europe and the US, but British audiences were notably smaller and quieter than other lectures, something Amundsen took as an insult, and there was still no word of Scott.
Oh, goodness.
The men had to wait all winter before they can even begin looking for Scott.
Yeah.
And the polar team. With Cherry Garrard and a few other men leaving on October 30th, 1912, they found Scott and the men merely 1 mile south of One Ton Depot.
Oh my gosh, that's heartbreaking.
And if you remember, they set the depot like a couple miles short of where it was supposed to be originally.
Yeah.
And had it been set where it was supposed to be, they might have survived.
Because they set it a couple miles short already?
Mm-hmm. Like, on the first...
Wait, I'm confused.
When the first... We talked about the depot laying journeys in the first episode.
Yeah.
And they wanted to set it at, like, 82 degrees south, and they set it, like, just a couple miles short of that.
Okay, so if they needed to set it more short, they would survive.
If they had set it, like, where it was supposed to be originally, they would have survived.
I guess I'm, like, thinking about it. They're coming at a different angle, probably.
Yeah, because they're coming from the south, going north.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's what was in my brain. I was visualizing it at a different angle.
Yeah, because everything's upside down, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was like, why is this not processing in my brain?
So it's like all of these little things are going to start coming back to like bite them in the ass here with this.
Gosh, that stinks.
Yeah, it really does. So that's what Cherry Garrard was talking about when he was like, you know, it's just one more link in the chain to be broken, right?
Yeah.
A pair of the men's skis were sticking up out of the snow, and that's how they were able to find the site. We found them. To say it has been a ghastly day cannot express it, wrote Cherry Garrard of this experience. They found Scott, Bowers, and Wilson in the tent, along with their gear, a great number of geological and scientific specimens, and diaries and journals containing their stories, as well as the whereabouts of Oates and Evans, because they were not found in the tent. Cherry Garrard further writes, "We have everything, records, diaries, etc. They have, among other things, several rolls of photographs, a meteorological log kept up to 13 March, considering all things, and a great many geological specimens. And they have stuck to everything. I think they realize they're coming in a long time before."
Oh, that's sad.
So they made sure to
March
preserve.
7th. Yeah, March 7th was when they were trying to find, like, the word was out about trying to find them.
Yeah.
And then March 13th was the last log.
Yeah.
So, like, and then he's like, they knew that they were gonna meet their end. Oh, that stinks.
Yeah. So now we'll get into exactly what happened, because, like I said, they have all the diaries. So we pretty much know exactly what happened.
That's so crazy.
I know. It's heartbreaking, but at the same time, it's like you see again where all of these little decisions that they made, like, screwed them over in the end.
Yeah, I just got chills. I got the goosies.
Oh, that's how we know it's good.
I know.
Scott's record showed a domino effect, slowly, steadily, over time, that led to this final demise. A series of small mistakes or unfortunate circumstances that ended the lives of 5 men. Upon the polar plateau, since the last return party had left them, diary entries start indicating that the men were beginning to feel the cold. And the surface they had traveled on created difficult travel as the snow crystals that cover the plateau, like, basically make sledging feel like pulling in sand.
Ooh, that sucks.
Yeah. In addition, the men were beginning to show the early signs of frostbite. However, they were treating it as best they could. And so early frostbite, I think, is just like you lose color in like your fingertips or
yeah, like you go white.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. On January 16th, they came across the Norwegians' tracks and black flags. The tracks had been there a few weeks at this point. Although they made it to the pole on the 17th, they knew they had been beaten. Scott lamented, "He has beaten us in so far as he made a race of it. We have done what we came for all the same, and our program was made out." Basically saying, like, we were going to go to the South Pole anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was the goal. They built a cairn at the pole, took photos, and left the Union Jack flying. They also found Admundson's flag above Polheim with a note showing the Norwegians' final calculations for the position. So it's like, here's the evidence. We found exactly where it was. And a letter for the King of Norway that Scott was to send upon his return, basically as like an honorable, like, hey, we've been beat, here's the proof kind of thing. Although they were all extremely disappointed, Scott and his men did bring it back with them as he wanted to take his loss with dignity. He writes of the letdown, "It is a terrible disappointment, and I am very sorry for my loyal companions. All the daydreams must go. It will be a wearisome return. The pole, yes, but under very different circumstances from those expected. Great God, this is an awful place."
Great all God, in all, this is an awful place.
They're finally just like, God, this sucks!
Yeah.
All in all, it had taken the five men 75 days to travel from Hut Point to the South Pole.
Oh, wow.
And it took Admundson 99 days there and back.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Because he had all the dogs, right? Mm-hmm. Admundson did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a couple pictures. And they look fucking miserable.
They do.
They're pole
the one
pictures.
Guy on the left.
Yeah.
Like, shrugged over, like his body language just says it all.
Yeah. And I zoomed in on Scott, the next picture below. He looks rough.
Yeah, that's definitely frostbite happening to his face.
He looks fucking rough. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there, we can already tell from pictures that they are in no condition to be doing this, and they have to return home.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
So, despite this, they began their long return, knowing the depots would be their only salvation of returning. By January 21st, the crew began noticing that Seaman Evans was becoming run down and his frostbite was growing more severe. By January 31st, he was losing fingernails. So, he's the first to start to kind of decay. All the joy had gone from their sledging. They were hungry, they were cold, they were pulling heavy, and two of them were not fit, Cherry Garrard said, summarizing their journey back across the polar plateau. On the 30th of January, Wilson suffered a strained tendon and had to hobble alongside the sledge, giving the skis to Evans.
Oh.
By February 2nd, they had entered the glacier, and Scott suffered an injury to his shoulder, making three out of the five men now injured in some way or another.
Oh my goodness.
Which is like, it's so easy to injure yourself out here.
Yeah.
You know? And doing the work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
The condition of the party was becoming concerning. But as they descended the glacier, it began to warm up considerably from like what temperatures were on the plateau. And it offered them a welcome break. They were making decent time down the glacier, but Evans was still becoming noticeably weaker, unable to help with camp work. He also made several falls on the glacier, and I believe hit his head on one of them.
Oh my God.
So on February 16th, Evans collapsed, giddy and hallucinating.
Oh no.
They brought him into the tent, and he died that night.
Oh my goodness.
While his
and
decline.
That was still like a month before they were found. Oh my God.
So while his decline had been pretty notable, he was still pulling a sledge the day that he died.
That is insane.
So it wasn't like they were like, oh yeah, he's gone. He's done for. He was like not doing great, but he was still doing work.
Yeah, he was still capable of doing work.
Right. So it is a terrible thing to lose a companion in this way, but calm reflection shows that there could not have been a better ending to the terrible anxieties of the past week, physician Wilson wrote of the tragedy. Scott and Cherry Gerard both had theories as to why Evans died, including one, the rations they were eating was not supporting the work they were doing. And Evans, being the biggest guy, would feel that deficit first.
Yep.
And then two, the shock of walking on badly frostbitten feet combined with these unseen injuries where he fell.
Possibly a concussion, right?
Yes. Caused him to go into shock. Regardless, they now had more supplies for the remaining men. So maybe they could get the rest of them back.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, we already know they didn't, so.
Yeah, but like maybe in their brains, they're like, maybe we could do this. Yeah. Maybe it can happen.
Exactly. At this point, they were at the bottom of the glacier and they continued on to the barrier. They had made it to the lower barrier depot before disaster struck, a disaster which cemented their fates. An unexpected, extremely cold weather event hit, with temperatures plummeting to minus 30s by the day and minus 40s at night. And this is pretty unusual because they're traveling in the Antarctic summer. So this is conditions that you see more in the fall, spring, or winter.
Okay.
Basically. Unfortunately, too, at their last depot, they found a shortage of oil. And this oil was what they used for melting water and heating food. So then you start having to worry about risking dehydration.
Yep.
And you can't eat frozen food without breaking your fucking teeth. So it makes eating very, very difficult.
That's interesting.
So the oil that they had would barely get them to the next depot. Oates then also revealed that he had extremely bad frostbite on his feet. So that's number two. With bad frostbite.
Yeah.
At this point, they began to look at things with a dark tone, like they knew they were coming to an end. Cherry Garrard talks about the phenomenon, saying practically any man who undertakes big polar journeys must face the possibility of having to commit suicide to save his companions. More desirable to die than to live if things are bad enough. So basically,
oh my God.
Yeah, you have to accept that, hey, I might have to kill myself so that the others can go on without me and actually survive.
Oh my God. I
and
hate
stop
that
worrying
thought.
About trying to get me back if I'm like in bad shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Scott himself was also leaning towards this conclusion in his diary, but writing that I would like to track to the end, basically meaning I would like to keep a record, you know, until the end. By March 11th, things were going downhill and Oates was nearing his end. Scott and Wilson distributed the remaining opioid pills that they had, like for painkillers.
Yeah.
Instructing the remaining men on how to kill themselves if needed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's where we're at. They had 7 days worth of food left. And at their current pace, it was 8 or 9 days to 1 ton camp.
Oh my God.
So potentially they could make it. Potentially.
Yeah.
They
almost did.
I know.
That is so crazy.
I know. They absolutely had to keep moving despite the extreme cold. And Scott knew what was coming, writing, "We must go on, but now the making of every camp must be more difficult and dangerous. It must be near the end, but a pretty merciful end." Which I thought was interesting because I don't really see that as merciful.
Yeah, no.
So on March 14th, on top of a blizzard, the midday, so peak heat temperature plummeted to negative 43 degrees Fahrenheit.
God, that's cold.
And they were forced to make camp. Like, they physically could not go on.
God, that stinks. Because that, like, if they didn't do that, they probably would have made it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
In the middle of the night, Oates got up and said, "I am just going out and maybe sometime." He left and never returned.
Oh, my God.
Scott said of Oates' death, "We knew that poor Oates was walking to his death, but though we tried to dissuade him, we knew it was an act of a brave English gentleman, or a brave man and an English gentleman." So this is what they were talking about with, like, committing suicide.
Yeah, that's so sad.
In order to save the others. All three considered his disappearance as a sacrifice so that maybe, just maybe, Wilson, Bowers, and Scott could survive without Oates slowing them down.
That's so sad.
So the next day, the three remaining men actually marched through this weather on or until March 21st, when they were completely stopped in their tracks, just a few miles from One Ton.
That is so sad. And so, like, do they know how close they were to One Ton? I feel like they didn't, which is why they stopped. But, like, they had maps, or they had kind of created location points, right?
Yes, but they couldn't take any celestial readings
because
it's a blizzard.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they knew they were close because at one point, like, either Wilson or Bowers tries to, like, go out and try to find One Ton.
Yeah.
But, like, they were unable to do it.
Yeah, like, they're like, we know we're close. It's got to be around here somewhere. And, like, they're, like, walking, like, 60 feet or something.
Right. Like, and these are, like, whiteout conditions, right?
Yeah.
It's not like, it's not like, ugh, they can just walk around and find it.
Oh, that stinks.
Yeah. So all three had bad frostbite on their feet, too. So all three of them were starting to get to the point where they can't walk anymore.
Ugh.
They had ran out of oil, which was the only thing between them and thirst. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'd have to heat it up with their own body heat, and that can be very dangerous. Temperatures still peaked in the negative 40s and then plummeted at night.
Golly.
The blizzard carried on for over a week. They had no food, no water, and were at the mercy of the elements. Scott made his last entry on March 29th, merely stating, "For God's sake, look after our people." It is thought that the three died on or around this date, with Scott dying last.
Oh, God.
So that's how they... So it was all these little things that built up to when they got hit by that blizzard, they did not have enough.
Yeah, that stinks.
To make it through.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And, like, they had no control over that blizzard.
Mm-mm. But no, they of did... course not. No one ever has control over the weather. No.
But it's like, but they maybe could have had control over how much supplies they had.
Yeah. We're just, like, the method of how they're going about things, too.
Yeah, it's like the method of travel. And
Yeah.
Which is, it's sad. But it's like no one's ever done this before, too.
Yeah, so it's like they didn't know.
So they're using their best educated guess and what mm-hmm. has worked in other areas. With the bodies were letters addressed to all of the important significant others, like of the men and all of their friends, written by Scott himself. So that's why they think Scott was the last to go.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. In addition, Scott wrote a message to the public describing, in his words, the cause of the provision reserve loss. So, number one, the loss of pony transport in 1911 forced them to transport less supplies to the depot and get a later start than anticipated. Two, weather throughout the outward journey, as well as the current blizzard that had stopped them. And then three, on the return, soft snow on the lower glacier regions further reduced their pace. Scott mm-hmm. further wrote, "On our return, we did not get a single, completely fine day, and this with a sick companion enormously increased our anxieties and a shortage of fuel in our depots, for which I cannot account. And finally, but for the storm which has fallen on us within 11 miles of the depot, at which we hope to secure our final supplies. Upon finding the bodies of the three, a cairn was erected over the tent and a small funeral service was performed. Oates' body was looked for, but never found.
Ugh. It's probably buried in snow out there.
Yeah. And at this point, I think in the modern day, Scott's cairn is also buried in snow.
Oh, really?
You can't even go to the gravesite. Like, they know where it is, but you can't, like, see yeah. it. So I just have a little map kind of showing, you know, how close they were to finishing this.
Yeah.
And then where Oates and then Evans died. So.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Upon hearing the tragedy that befell Scott, Admundson's victory became muddled. While he was still considered the first to the pole, many, including those in Britain, claimed that his success was built upon deception and that he stole the march from Scott. There were claims of his lack of honor, considering the secretive nature surrounding his early plans to claim the pole. Other countries, however, including the U.S., saw that Admundson's victory was valid and his competitor had died in pursuit, meaning that Admundson's victory was hard-earned and deserved respect. You know, mm-hmm. basically, like, this, going to the pole was so difficult that his competitor died.
Yeah.
So, he's fucking badass, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like there was two different methods that were used in in the way to explore the South Pole.
Right.
And, like, as sad as it sounds, like, one was better than the other.
Right, right.
So, yeah. But, I mean, still, yeah, it's valid. It's just a different way to do it. And I don't know. I mean, it's never a good time when lives are lost. That's for sure.
No. And I get, like, the sadness. I mean, it is a very sad story. But at the same time, I feel like, and this is definitely, like, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the British, like, were like, everything's ours. We claim everything. And it's just kind of like, it's not yours. It's not yours.
Yeah.
Like, who said you got to, like, claim taking the South Pole?
Yeah.
Like, I don't see any issues really in what Admundson was like, let's go do the South Pole. Why not? Right?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't belong to anybody.
And it doesn't. They're like, let's just go try it.
Yeah. And they just planned way better. Right?
Yeah, so, it's always like a sad story when it's like two people are going for the same mission. One plans better than the other. Like, you never want to wish ill upon somebody, but then it's like, you see how the planning was done differently and it turned out to be a much better experience for one team rather than the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sad.
Mm-hmm. So opinions of both men changed throughout the centuries. Admundson was often evoked as the hardest of leaders, taking whatever measures necessary to achieve his goals, overly ambitious, but also in recent times, he's considered meticulous and had a remarkable ability to calculate the odds. And often they talk about, like, well, he killed a ton of dogs to do what he had to do. And it's like, Scott killed ponies.
Yeah, it's like animals were both harmed in the making of this journey.
Exactly. So it's just like, I don't really know if that's a valid argument, because that's just fucking how it was back then.
Yeah.
And that's the sacrifice they all were willing to make in order to get to the pole.
Mm-hmm.
So... Scott's heroism persisted until the last quarter of the 20th century, when some considered him a failure, largely because of his own mistakes. He was also considered a bumbling hero, which, as many of you probably agree, is nowhere near correct. In the early 21st century, while mistakes were made on the English expedition, the many situations that arose contributed to Scott's death were beyond his control. So his reputation was somewhat restored in modern times and seen more as, like, you know, a tragedy, you know. That's ultimately what it was. But the rivalry and controversy still surrounds the whole ordeal.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have a lot of different opinions. And to me, I'm like, if you weren't there, your opinion ain't valid.
Yeah, seriously,
mean?
it's one of those things where it's like, have you seen that meme where it's like me watching the Olympics, like stuffing food in my face? It's like, oh, that was a terrible like dismount or whatever. It's like, I could do better than that. It's like, dude, you're watching this shit from like the comfort of your home on your couch. Like you're not fit to do those things. And it's like the similar thing where it's like, have you been to the South Pole? Have you gone on any journeys? Like,
It's like
you're not
fucking
fit to do any of
armchair
this.
explorers,
Yeah.
which I know I realize is kind of what we are, but I like to like give a lot of different perspectives. Like, you know what I
Yeah.
mean? I'm not gonna just sit here and judge something I didn't know. Like, I can have my opinions about it, but I'm also gonna acknowledge like these are circumstances I will never experience, hopefully.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what I would do in those
Right.
ex like experiences. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that should be the new name of our podcast, Armchair Explorer.
Yeah. That's true.
Amundsen went on to many more expeditions, mainly in the Arctic, his favored location. He became one of the first humans to see both poles when he flew over the North Pole in 1926.
Oh, wow, that's neat.
Amundsen's, yeah, that's kind of a cool, like, got to see both. Pretty
Yeah.
sweet. Amundsen's life, however, also ended in tragedy in 1928 when Amundsen went on a rescue mission. The airship Italia had gone down north of Svalbard en route to the North Pole. Amundsen took off in a plane after them, but the aircraft was not designed for those conditions. He went down somewhere in the Norwegian Sea and was never found, but he did die a real hero on his way to save others.
Oh.
In 1956, the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station was established, named to honor both men. The station is run by the United States Antarctic Program and sits at the geographic South Pole. It houses scientists year-round and is the furthest south structure on the planet. Glaciology, geophysics, meteorology, atmosphere physics, astronomy, astrophysics, and biomedical research all goes on at the South Pole Station. So Scott's legacy of science and scientific exploration continues down at the South Pole.
That's nice.
And that is the story of the South Pole race.
It always amazes me how they get materials to the poles, like the South
Yeah.
Pole, to build a research station.
I
Like,
know. It's wild.
it's just like a building on the South Pole.
Yeah, and it's
So wild.
huge.
Yeah.
I follow a couple people that are like stationed down there. It's really fascinating. Follow them on TikTok.
That's
So
in
they do
yeah.
like video tours of the place. It's really interesting.
Yeah, that's neat.
And if you scroll down, there is a picture. And they do have the
I
little
see
barber
that.
shop thing on the pole.
Yeah, I see that. That's funny that they did that. That's good for them.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. And all of the different, you know, nations that do research there are represented, including Norway and England. So,
Yeah, I see that. That's awesome.
yeah. So that's kind of the legacy of that race, is this station.
Well, that's a really good story. I think it's really interesting that, there was two different methods like of going to the South Pole. Because that's one thing where it's like, I don't know. I feel like typically, like, we talked about the space race. To me, there didn't seem to be that big of a difference in the methods of getting to space,
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're
So.
gonna sit on a rocket. Like, there's no way around it. Now, how strong or fast or whatever that rocket is, that's I guess maybe where the difference lies. But like,
Yeah, but I don't know what those things are. So to me, in my basic knowledge of that, I'm like, oh, it seems like, two people trying to do the same thing in it the same way.
Yeah.
Let's see who
And I
does it
think
first.
a lot of it's like differences in culture, you know,
Yeah.
because I feel like Norwegians live in an already like Arctic environment. And so they are so used to cross-country skiing or sled dogging, all these things, whereas the English were like military then. you know.
Yeah.
They're like, well, we're going to do it with our own strength, you know.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think that's part of it as well.
I mean, I believe that. I mean, it's like what they're used to, right? It's like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we're done with Antarctica for a while.
Well, that was a good story.
Yeah, I felt like this one needed to be told because it's like one of the biggest stories that took place on the continent. It's one of the most iconic stories, really.
Yeah.
And you can go see Scott's old huts and like their bases on
really?
McMurdo or on Ross Island near McMurdo. So
that's, I mean, I think it would be cool to go visit Antarctica.
Yeah.
But I just, that's one of those things that's, it's a wish. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's not like a reality for me.
Yeah. I'd like to try to make it happen in my lifetime, but I realize that I am just a mere human and
yeah,
we'll see. We'll
yeah.
See. All right. So after we talked about killing dogs and ponies, which is always a depressing time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sad that like Scott and all his men died too, but what do we all cry about when we watch the movie? It's because somebody killed the dog, and that is, we're not okay. We're not okay with that.
Yeah.
Happy things.
Happy things. Yeah, happy things. We got our living room finally done. So that's a happy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like one more box that's checked in the house renovation plan.
Yeah, that's nice though.
Yeah, I know it is. So I'm happy about that. And then other happy thing is my dad is coming to visit soon because I asked him to come down and help me with something to surprise Alex with when Alex is out of town for a few days. So, and that thing is doing our bedroom. So we have two walls up in our bedroom right now, and we only need the other two done, and then spackle, and prime paint, whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm gonna hopefully get that done while Alex is out of town so he can come back home to a room that he doesn't have to tear down anymore.
Yay! That's a nice surprise, though. That's really nice.
Because I can tell it's like kind of like weighing on him, like where it's like, oh, we have to do like two more walls, like we have to do this room, we have to do that room, and it's like, I don't know, for me I'm like, the living room's done, and then in my mind I know that that bedroom's gonna get done soon. So then in my mind I'm like, that's enough of the house for us to do physically for a while. So that's good, because the kitchen and half master bathroom I'm gonna hire people to do. So like, we don't need to do that. So then, like, I told him, I was like, you know, because he doesn't know about the surprise, but I do. And so in my mind, I'm like, you know, if I get this quote back from this plumber and it's like a decent quote, like, and we can do it, then like this house could be done by the end of the year, which is awesome. Like, and then we don't have to do anything anymore. We can just actually live in it and decorate it and just enjoy it, you know, get new furniture, a new couch. So,
it'll be worth it, especially because a lot of it is cosmetic. And not like crazy big renovations, but it'll be worth it in the end.
I mean, the house is a small footprint. It's not like we got a lot to work with in the first place.
Right. Yeah.
So, it's like you said, it's just cosmetic. And I mean, the kitchen is honestly the most annoying part of the house for me, because we have like two base cabinets worth of counter space. And that's it.
Yeah.
So with the new plan, we would have like about 4.5 base cabinets worth of counter space. So it would be nice. And then like a larger island, because we'd put a dishwasher in. That'd be so nice to have a dishwasher.
Dude, yeah. Moving from my old house to here, we didn't have a dishwasher at the old house. We have one here. It's like, oh God, I miss this so much.
Yeah. I mean, all throughout college, I lived without a dishwasher. So, you know, to me, I was like, this is fine. And then when I moved here to Florida, I was living in houses with dishwashers again. So I was like, this is so great. And then I moved down to the Keys, and my first house had a dishwasher. And then I got this house, and this house didn't have a dishwasher. But in my mind, I'm like, that's fine, because like, I can hand wash dishes. I've done it before. And there's space to put a dishwasher in if I want to do that. So that's, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess that's my happy thing, is the house renovations are coming along well. And I'm hopeful that they'll be done by the end of the year.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I guess my happy thing is that my brother came down kind of, again, on a whim for Memorial Day weekend. And we had a bunch of people over last night and had a really good time. And it was nice. That and my garden is like going crazy with tomatoes right now. Like, I have so many and I have a ton of green beans. And so it's just nice to like reap the rewards, basically.
Yeah.
But we have so many. I'm going to be like canning and like making salsa and marinara sauce and all that good stuff. So I'm excited about it. Oh,
that's so fun.
Yeah. Because I actually have enough. I have enough to do that this year. So
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah. All right. So where can our listeners find us?
Great question. Our listeners can find us on the social medias at Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast on Instagram. Facebook is Mother Nature Will Kill You. TikTok is MNWKY Podcast. And we also have a website, mothernaturewillkillyoupodcast.com. And then you can listen to us on all streaming platforms, including Google Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts.
Yeah. And if you've gone to the South Pole, we want to hear about it. But yeah, if you haven't been to the South Pole, if instead maybe you had a fun adventure in Alaska and maybe ran into a bear like Haley did, or maybe you had a scary time out at sea, we want to hear about that too. You can submit it to, we have a like story submission page on our website, or you can send it to the email. Also, if you want to support the podcast, but we live in a post-apocalyptic hellscape. So, did I say post-apocalyptic again?
You did. I was like, you said it again.
God damn. I've been doing this for like how many years now? And for whatever reason, all of a sudden, my brain's like, nope, no more. Post-capitalist hellscape. That's where we live. You can give us a 5-star review on any listening platform.
Yes.
To tell the algorithm to make people listen to us. And that's all I have to say.
Yes.
So with that.
Until next time, explorers. Is that my line? Until next time. See, I told you it happens to me all the time. Well, until next time, stay safe. But most of all,
stay curious, explorers.
That's where I was getting the explorers from. Uh-huh. I knew it was in there somewhere. Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye.